Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's September 3rd. Currently 54 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 57 degrees under mostly sunny skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back as we go throughout your Thursday. Look for mostly sunny skies, windy conditions expected for us this afternoon. Temperatures very pleasant. Low 70s expected around Park City this afternoon. We're looking at high temperatures for your Thursday, climbing into the upper 70s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Friday, look for mostly sunny skies. Again, windy conditions expected across the Wasatch Back. We'll see those high temperatures in the mid-70s in Park City, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s in the Heber Valley. Once we make our way into the upcoming weekend, it starts off pretty nice with lots of sunshine. We'll call it mostly sunny for your Saturday. High temperatures will be in the mid-70s in Park City. We'll be in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. By the time we move towards your Sunday, we'll start to get some moisture moving in from the south. That'll lead to a chance of a few scattered showers and thunderstorms as we get towards your Sunday afternoon with high temperatures back down to the lower 70s in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. Our Labor Day right now looks to be the wettest day over the next 7 days, sadly, and that's going to mean showers and thunderstorms, likely at least periods of showers and thunderstorms during the day on Labor Day. That's going to be thanks to a tropical system down well to our south. It's not going to make direct landfall on the U.S., but it will send a surge of tropical moisture our way as we head towards your Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So Sunday and Monday, again, bringing the wettest conditions with Monday right now looking like the wettest day. It will also be the coolest day. Temperatures may not get out of the 60s for many of the higher elevations here across the Wasatch Back, including places like Park City. We may stay with the 60s for highs as we go throughout your Labor Day. High temperatures should climb into the lower 70s in the Heber Valley. Now, we'll start to dry things out heading into early next week. So Tuesday into Wednesday, we'll just call it partly cloudy skies and a chance of a pop-up storm or two. Highs will be in the low 70s in Park City, mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Megan McKenna. She'll recap last night's meeting that went actually into the early hours of this morning, I'm guessing. I heard Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History's Don Roll, Colleen Logan, and project manager Wayne McKay with details on the opening of a 7-mile historic tour trail. And Brent Grigill, competition director for Park City Ski and Snowboard, is in to tell us about the need for volunteers for competitions and other events. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Dr. Raj Shari, exploring how CRISPR and other powerful tools can help scientists understand cancer at its genetic roots. Then, long before smartphones and AI, a band of rebel gamblers was using high math, hidden computers, and early technology to beat the odds. Conversation about pioneering innovations that would shape the future of computing and IA. That's coming up on Cool Science Radio. Of course, you can hear Cool Science Radio every Thursday at 9 a.m. Heber City leaders approved 3 new public infrastructure districts for development north of downtown. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports council members say these PIDs could help more people achieve home ownership.
Heber council members say they decided in favor of the new Tava Highlands Public Infrastructure Districts, or PIDs, because the tool could help first-time homebuyers afford a down payment. PIDs have been available to Utah developers since 2019. They're a way to use bonds to pay for infrastructure in new development. The debt is repaid through special assessments levied on property owners within the PID boundaries. Throughout the summer, council members remained uncertain about whether to allow 3 PIDs in the Highlands, a development of over 800 homes near the Utah Valley University Wasatch campus. But at a meeting Tuesday, the council said it's negotiated an agreement that will benefit the city. Councilmember Aaron Sheetwood asked the developers to include information about home costs with and without the PIDs in every property sale, essentially a more detailed version of the state's disclosure requirements.
I want every potential buyer to know that they're buying something with, yes, they've got a potential, or they've got a definite impact in their future taxes, but they're also seeing the benefit right now and be able to get into potentially something that they couldn't get into if it was $40,000 higher.
The PIDs mean that buyers' mortgages will be less expensive, but property taxes will be higher. Sheetwood had previously been critical of the proposal, but said Tuesday he's come to believe the PIDs will benefit residents. The city also negotiated over $2 million for public benefits from the developer, including $1.6 million for a new section of College Way, $400,000 for improvements to the neighborhood playground, and $70,000 for the dog park. Councilmember Yvonne Barney abstained from the vote, saying she likes the project but doesn't like PIDs.
I really have a hard time with trying to negotiate with how I felt so long against PIDs and still do. But with this project, I feel very strongly that this will be something that will benefit our community, and I'm really looking forward to what you have to bring forward.
The rest of the council unanimously supported creating the districts. Construction of the Highlands began in fall 2024, and developers hope to finish building by spring 2028. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council met yesterday, and in studio with a recap is Summit County Council member Megan McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So it sounds like it was a very long meeting, huh?
It was a very long meeting, that's right.
And going until about midnight?
I think we dismissed just right after midnight.
Okay, which explains the text I received from the county manager. He was up. Let's see, the council, and we got, 13 minutes to talk about it. The council took a site visit to the Peak Center. What did you think?
Oh, this was so exciting. We haven't seen it in a little while, and as you know, we'll be doing our grand opening on Saturday, October 3rd. So still a little bit of work to be done, but it looks awesome. So we're all really excited to open the library, the DMV, and the council chambers are on the first floor.
Okay, and then how's the second floor coming along?
Looks really good too. It'll just be a little bit further behind. We didn't tour the second floor. There's still a lot of demolition happening, but a lot of work being done.
Okay, the council got a presentation from Jackie's Recovery Support Services, Executive Director Javier Allegra. He is looking for space since this organization will be displaced from the Richens building. Maybe this was formerly known as Latino Behavioral Health. So why the name change? And can you tell us who's Jackie?
Yeah, and that's what Javier mentioned in the introduction. They organized in 2013, and Jackie was the founding member. She has since passed away about 9 years ago. And so this was a recent tribute that they decided to do in her honor. And so they are still Latino Behavioral Health and just changed the name to recognize her.
Okay, so it is a behavioral health program and wants the council to look into providing a new facility for their work at Quinn's Junction. So how does the council feel about this?
Well, you know, this meeting or this work session was really just to give council a better understanding and the public a better understanding of the work that Jackie's Recovery does. There was really no action and there'll be no decision on the council for this. But I think because we gave the People's Health Clinic an opportunity to talk about the work that they do in that building, we felt it was important that they also had the opportunity.
So what kind of services does the organization provide?
They're really focused on integrated behavioral health. So from crisis services, medication management, they talked about peer support therapy, psychoeducation, case management, support groups for youth and for adults, criminal justice involved cases, unhoused, and medical and school settings.
So can you talk about the patient numbers and how those look compared to the numbers that the People Health Clinic serves?
I don't have the numbers and how they compare. They had that in their presentation. I don't know those off the top of my head. But really, it was just kind of an overview of the work that they do.
Okay, so what happens now?
So, you know, as we talked about before, it's really, this is a staff level decision. So the county manager and Dr. Phil Bondurant, our Department of Health director, will look at the space that they have and with the move into the Peak Center, determine the best use of that space with the Intermountain Health and People's Health Clinic.
Okay, let's see, later on the council discussed and approved Ordinance 1016. This was an ordinance to streamline the rezoning process. Staff says the ordinance is meant to reduce government bureaucracy and reduce the time staff needs to review work. You voted yes on the ordinance?
I did.
How come?
I really think that this is will help streamline the process and will really help to support the kind of responsible development that we would like to see in the community. Really, it does not change or modify zoning standards. It doesn't change permitted uses or underlying density. The developer will still have to go through the same process. It's really just the procedure. And I think this ordinance will allow the public really to weigh in even earlier. So really, it's just changing when that more high-level plan takes place.
Councilmember Roger Armstrong had some serious concerns that the ordinance would reduce county control and development and make rezoning easier. Community members previously shared similar concerns. Were those concerns resolved?
I think that was something that was really important to staff and to those of us that voted for the ordinance to try to address ahead of time. There seems to be a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions about what this ordinance does. And as I said, these amendments, they just modify and amend that process and start the process with a conceptual development plan. But ultimately, those zoning standards and permitted uses are not changed. They're just dealt with at a later stage. So really, I think this is better for the public to have an opportunity to weigh in earlier. And I think it's important to point out that the Planning Commission agreed and unanimously recommended this ordinance. One of the planning commissioners saying we should have done this a long time ago.
So was the council vote unanimous?
It was not. It was 3-2.
Okay. Who voted against?
Chair Hart and Vice Chair Armstrong.
Okay. And again, this came out in response to a project from Columbus Pacific that has been going on for some 4 years. And it's taken so long because the original application didn't meet the zone. I mean, if people bring an application that fits the zone, it's not going to take 4 years, is it?
Well, I think we had two good examples of this later in the agenda, two rezone applications that have taken years to get to this point. And I think the part that I would like to highlight is because of that time and energy and money put into those extensive development plans early on in the process, I think that really takes away from the affordability later on in the project. And I think those two examples, rezone applications that we saw, really highlight that.
Again, I mean, those are rezone applications. And I guess with so many complaints that we have about all of the development and about growth, the rezone process is a form of growth control. And I guess the only one upset about that is the developer, no?
No, I don't think so. And as I mentioned, I think that that process, and that's the status quo, what we have right now, I think it really does favor bigger development that can afford that has a larger profit margin. I think by streamlining this process, really we can allow for more smaller, more responsible development and allow for more affordability in a project.
All right, Community Development Director Peter Barnes said that the ordinance will lead to a more transparent process. How so? You had said, people learn about it early on, but you know, I've been through enough of these to know that I talked about Dakota Pacific's project for years, and it wasn't until a final vote before the county council when things blew up.
Right. And I think that's exactly where this comes in. So during that initial phase, that conceptual development plan, there would be an opportunity for the public to weigh in before the details are really tied down to a project. And so really it gives the Planning Commission, it gives the public, and then it gives the council an opportunity to weigh in. And if it's not something that meets the criteria of a rezone, it would not proceed, you know, beyond that that initial phase. But if it is something, you know, then we could really start weighing in, you know, taking some of the feedback from the public and really try to make a better project.
Well, I guess if we don't have the details early on, how can we make comments on something we don't know about?
Well, and that was some of the feedback, you know, that was given. And so if you look at the ordinance, the detail in the conceptual development plan actually really, really does give us a lot of information. Including the density of the project. So if a project goes through this process and is given a rezone, they can't go back and change the density or the amount of open space. And so a conceptual development plan isn't just a sketch. There's still quite a bit that goes into the planning at that stage. But the details that, you know, really aren't necessary at that stage will come later in the process. And something to point out that the conceptual development plan would be incorporated into a development agreement. And that's really when some of those details would be laid out.
Okay. County Council was also considering revoking the CUP from soil to spoil. It sounds like you did move forward with that?
No, we did not take action on this. We were already quite a bit behind at this point, and we did look. I think if listeners recall, back in October of last year, we issued 9 notices of violation, and with those 9 violations, we assigned cure periods. And so in December of last year, and then April and July of this year, we are... code enforcement went back and reviewed those violations to see if they had been cured. And so we had over an hour and a half of deliberation. The appellant really tried to give their case, and we decided at that time we would need more time to deliberate. And so we will continue to look at those violations and then determine if those violations should result in a revocation of the CUP. Mm-hmm. And it should be pointed out, too, that the Planning Commission last year did recommend the revocation, and we really wanted to give the give soil to spoil an opportunity to cure those.
Okay, so is the appellant, I mean, do you feel like adjustments are being made?
It looks like some adjustments have been made in some of them and not in others. And so we were presented actually with some additional materials from the appellant last night. So we'll need more time to go through those. And so that's what we'll have to determine.
All right. And then later on, 2 public hearings held. The first one on the crossroads at Silver Creek. I'm thinking this is the 4-year project that kind of started mm-hmm. all of the rezoning ordinance 1016 to come about. So with the approval of that ordinance, did the council take action on this development?
Yeah, it's too late for this development. So they were applying for a rezone. They went through the current process that we have, and that's what was on the table for us last night. So as you mentioned, we held a public hearing, and we did approve the crossroads at Silver Creek for a rezone from rural residential to community commercial.
Right, and so what that did was now allowed 90 residential units, 32,000 square feet of commercial on 14 units, and that was considerably downsized from what was originally presented. So, council thinking that makes sense in that location?
Yeah. This also came with a unanimous positive recommendation from the Planning Commission. As you mentioned, it was scaled back quite a bit from their previous application that was for a mixed-use development. But yeah, it met the criteria. It's compatible with adjacent land use. It's compliant with all of the standards, and so it we believed the majority of us believed that it had a compelling countervailing public interest with the affordable housing, multimodal transport, neighborhood services, park, transit stop, trails, and it does seem to fit that area.
So a bus will be coming to Silver Creek, huh?
Eventually, that is part of the plan. So they'll be responsible for building that transit stop there.
All right. A second public hearing held on the mixed-use redevelopment project at Junction Commons. This has been before the council for a bit. So what did you decide here?
Yeah, and so this one, this is the one that took us into the late hour, and we were actually in the process of making a motion when we realized that it wasn't agendized properly, and so it wasn't noticed on the agenda for a rezone, and so we actually did not take action on this, but I think we had a really good, robust discussion about the affordable housing component of this project. And so we did schedule a special meeting that will be posted tomorrow for next Tuesday, the 8th. There will be a special meeting for possible action for an MPD rezone to neighborhood mixed use for Junction Commons.
All right, so this, the motion that was going to be made would have been for approval?
It would have been for approval with conditions. Mm-hmm. And so I think actually the time will be helpful to spell out all of those conditions that that we were discussing in the meeting. And so those will be included on the updated agenda.
Yeah, we heard so much early on in the process that county leaders really like this redevelopment, but certainly concerned about the traffic given the other development in the area. So how did things get worked out with that?
Yeah, it's as you mentioned, this has been put to us several times. I think this was our fifth meeting with the developer. And yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of positive feedback. I think, with being a redevelopment, you know, you're thinking about what it is currently and what they're proposing. And I think all of us agreed that what they're proposing is a much better use of that land.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Megan?
Yeah, well, you know, just with all this affordable housing discussion, I'd love to mention that the Summit County Housing Authority is hosting our third quarterly housing speaker series on the 15th of September. That'll be at the Camas Branch Library at 5:30. And in this session, we'll be discussing seniors and housing. And I think it's a really important topic, and I would encourage those who have questions and are interested in learning more to attend. And I really think it takes a village at every life stage. We'll certainly be talking about senior housing, but also how affordable housing supports our aging population. And so I would just encourage folks to attend and learn more about affordable housing.
Okay, Megan McKenna, Summit County Council Member, thanks so much for your time. On Miner's Day, friends of Ski Mountain Mining History will unveil the new 7-mile trail loop. In the studio with details, I have the Friends co-chair Don Roll, Colleen Logan, and project manager Wayne McKay. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Morning.
Good morning.
Don, maybe you start and tell us, what is the historic mine route, and what do you hope people experience when they hike, or they can bike it as well?
They can hike, bike, or take the chairlift. There's the three different options. So the whole goal of this project is to provide both our community and visitors a way to learn more about our mining history. We're often up there when we're doing the four-year Silver King mine building project. We've been up there, and then people, it's amazing how much traffic in summer there is up there between the hikers and bikers, et cetera. And they look at the interpretive sign, which has about 80 words on it, and they say, can you tell me more? And that's really the purpose, is to tell more through the audio narratives, the 24 audio narratives that you will experience if you do the entire 7 mile loop.
Okay, so as you mentioned, the route is 7 miles and it climbs roughly 1,200 feet. I mean, how challenging is it, and who was it designed for? Is that Wayne? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take that one. Yeah, it is challenging. It's a moderate plus type hike. We have listed on the website each of the trails that are involved in the full loop and what their difficulty ratings are. But we're also encouraging people to think about shorter options. There's, as Don said, the chairlifts from Townlift or Payday Express will take visitors straight to the Silver King Mine Complex, which is really one of the highlights of the tour. And then you can either take the chairlift back down or continue to walk through Empire Canyon all the way back to Main Street and Park City Museum. There are also a couple of other shorter route options that we will advertise on the website for people to choose from.
Okay, so were you able to piece the trail together using existing trails and roads, or did you actually have to cut new trail?
Great question. I'd say about 90% of it is on existing trails that Mountain Trails Foundation maintains and has developed. There is one section that's about a half a mile that'll be what we're calling a new connector, which will cut out about a mile and a quarter of walking that will take you from the Silver King Woodside Gulch area into Empire Canyon, where the Judge Mine and the Alliance Mines have a lot of stories to share there. But so there's a half a mile out of 7 miles that will be kind of a new connector.
Hmm. So we're waiting for the Redis land transfer for the city. The city will own that land. Right now it's owned by TCFC, United Park City Mines. And they said, look, we're in the process of deeding the land to the city. Can you wait until that's done before we cut the trail, before we get the permission to cut the trail?
Yeah.
And Mountain Trails Foundation is all lined up. They said it'll take a week. Yeah. But it looks like that's going to be a next summer. And right now it's a gravel path.
All right. There are 24 historic sites along the route. So this made the best location in Park City to kind of do this? Is that where the majority of the historic mine sites are?
Well, we're so lucky here in Park City that so many of our iconic mine sites are so close to Main Street. That was one of the things that we thought was really important, is to make sure that it was easy accessibility. We have the beautiful Park City Museum right on Main Street. And we have the access with the chairlifts, which is essential if people are unable or not willing to do the full loop. And so there's many other mine sites that are out there, and perhaps next summer or in future summers we'll launch spur trails. But right now, this makes a really nice loop, or as Wayne said, some other options. And what I think is so cool about the free audio guide that you can download from our website is that you really get a sense of the entire gamut of processes that it takes to ore, silver, and mine for it. We have, of course, a professional narrator for our audio guide, but we also have an incredible number of experts on the Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History who are mining engineers, mining experts, geologists, paleontologists, local history experts. So what's neat is that you get a lot of community voices telling the stories of mining, drain tunnels, extraction, crushing, sampling, everything involved in the mining process.
And the route uses what's called GPS-triggered audio. So how does that work?
It's really easy. You go to our new website, which is hmr.parkcityhistory.org, or you just go to the museum's website. There's a banner at the top. Download the free audio guide, which is from Travel Stories. There's actually one already out from the Chamber called Experience Park City. And then when you have the app open and you approach each of the sites, the geotag or the GPS automatically triggers the audio. So what's great about it for all of us who are hiking or biking is that you don't have to touch buttons on your phone. You just approach it, and it's kind of like having a friend right next to you saying, hey, and now look at this. You can experience all of the audio signals.
And most of the audio segments are 2 to 3 minutes, so you get quite a bit of information in a short period of time. Yeah. And, you know, as we like to say, it tells the story of the miners, the families, the immigrants, entrepreneurs, and community members who helped build Park City what it is today.
Yeah, so again, you can get a lot more information for a shorter amount of time than you could just on a sign.
Exactly.
Do you have new signs up as well?
Right. We have, there are, along the 7 mile route, there were already eight interpretive signs that have been put up by the museum and by the Friends organization in past years. We've added 11 more to that eight around the full loop. So yes, there are new interpretive signs up there with historic photos and narratives that describe the story of each site.
We also tried to accommodate people who are already on the mountain. They're not starting from down from Main Street at the museum. And so we've populated 12 QR codes on the route, and you could just hit the QR code to hear the narrative for that particular site. And then, of course, there's a little plug, you know, why don't you download the Travel Stories app so you can hear more.
Do the whole thing.
Yeah, so Wayne, what was kind of that your biggest challenge in creating the route? I mean, was it finding the right connections, interpreting the history, getting permission, paying for it?
All the above, but a couple things. First of all, we've never done anything like this. I mean, our focus has been primarily on preservation. We're going to save our 15th mining structure with the Thames Mine this summer, and then promoting our mining history through hikes, ski tours, and lectures. So developing an app and a whole experience, a community experience, is pretty was fairly challenging for us. Took about 2 years, and the other big piece was funding. So Utah Outdoor Recreation provided us the base grant that we needed to get going. And then since then, we have developed another 12 grants for both implementation as well as marketing. So, because if you can put this thing together, but unless you get the word out, nobody will know about it. So we've thanks to Colleen, doing quite a bit of marketing around the launch. And thankfully, between the 14 grants that we have, over 90% of the cost of the of implementing the trail and marketing the trail has been covered by grants. And it's state grants, federal grants, county grants, local grants. So it's been a true Utah-wide effort to bring this to reality.
Yeah. So what was final project cost?
It's around $220,000. Including the marketing implementation. It's about 120 to actually implement the trail.
Yeah, so why do you think it's important for people to see these historic structures in the landscape where it actually happened rather than, you know, walking through the museum?
Well, I think it's important because that's how Park City became Park City. Our silver mining heritage is who we are. And that's been the entire foundation of Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History, is to preserve our heritage so that we don't become just another resort town. It is what makes us distinct. And again, we're so lucky that it's right there. I mean, you go to the Bonanza Chairlift in every season and you see the mighty Silver King, the one that we just spent 4 years restoring, and that $16 billion in today's money got pulled out of that shaft. I mean, it's why Park City is Park City.
And heritage tourism is really a fast-growing sector of the tourism industry. And this is not only is it heritage tourism, it's also sustainable because it's all hiking and biking. So it really hits a couple of the tourism hotspots for adventures when you come to Park City. It's a new adventure.
Yeah, now the Silver King Coalition Mine Headframe, as you mentioned, Colleen, is one of the centerpiece sites. I mean, is there one site or story along the route that you wouldn't want people to miss?
Oh, well, my favorite is the Alliance Watchman's Cabin, which is on your way down into Empire Canyon. And it's the story of Jack Gallivan, who started his life, spent the first 6 years of his life living in the cabin with his father. His father passed away. He was adopted by his aunt, Jenny Judge, and ended up becoming publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune. and directly helped by lobbying JFK to get the economic development loan to create Treasure Hill, Treasure Mountain, which was, now, of course, Park City Mountain. Without that economic grant, we might not have a ski town. Mm-hmm. So I just love that story because it ties our skiing, our mining history back to our current day skiing.
Yeah, so I think that's near, what was it, the assayer's office or...
It's near the judge office building.
It's
just up the hill.
Which is two buildings, I think, that you want to renovate, yeah?
Thanks to our friends at the city and Empire Pass Master Owner Association, we've already redone the roof of the judge building. There was a desire many, many years ago to make it a residence. It is a long, long way from happening that, but it is... sturdy, has a roof on it, and maybe we'll get back around and put windows. Right now it's boarded, the windows and doors are boarded up, but that would be the next step.
Yeah, how about you, Wayne? Any site that you wouldn't want people to miss?
Well, I think we've already mentioned it, but the Silver King mine complex area, I think, is one of the most interesting. As a retired engineer myself, just learning about how the operation worked over the years, when it was first developed in the 1880s and then rebuilt several times over the coming decades. We're, as Colleen mentioned already, we're really fortunate that there's as many still existing and still standing structures from the mine history in this area. I've been to a lot of ski resorts around the West that have mining history, but none that I can think of that have this many existing structures that are still there to see. And then the one thing I'd just like to add overall is I think that's unique about this experience for visitors and locals is that it's self-guided. You don't need to hire a tour guide or sign up with a tour group to experience the history.
Okay. Let's see. Where do people get maps?
Get maps at the museum, of course. You can also go to our website, hmr.parkcityhistory.org. You can download maps from there. There's also QR codes in the window of the museum and posters around town. And then if you're coming to the Miners' Day Parade on Monday, we'll be giving out exactly what you have in your hand right now, Leslie, a map with a QR code that goes to the website. And we'll be cutting a 16-foot-long ribbon that spans Main Street. It'll be right there at the judges' stand, 505 Main Street, because, of course, the Park City Historic Mine Route starts on Main Street. So,
okay, real quick, I wanted to give you an opportunity just to tell us about your annual Cocktails with the Friends. That's coming up September 12th.
Yeah, the thanks to Park City Mountain and Epic Promise, they are hosting our a cocktail party up at Lookout Canyon. So we'll take the orange bubble up. We'll spend 2.5 hours up there enjoying the views and having some sumptuous appetizers and drinks before descending back down, hopefully during the sunset.
Okay, tickets, $200, I think.
$200, and you can go to our... website, parkcityhistory.org, click on events, and it's September 12th at 5 o'clock.
Okay, well, congratulations getting this done. Looks exciting. Can't wait to go.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, you
Thanks.
Bet. That's Don Wohl, Colleen Logan, and Wayne McKay with Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, while the snow is still months off, Park City Ski and Snowboard already lining up volunteers for its upcoming events. In the studio with me, I have the new competition director, Brent Greigel. Good morning, Brent.
Hey, good morning, Leslie.
Yeah, so you have taken on actually the role of events and competitions director with Park City Ski and Snowboard. What does that position involve?
Yeah, actually, I'm going into my second season here, and it really involves organizing and managing all the hosted events we have for our athletes throughout the winter. And then on top of that, in the summer, doing our Moose in the Loose and some other fundraising events as well, helping out with that, like Ski Swap coming up in November.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about your background in winter sports and what kind of brought you to this position.
Right on. Yeah, my background, I'm an East Coast guy, grew up ski racing back east and did that through college at Plymouth State. And then after that, got into coaching. And then from there, got into event management at Sunday River back east and worked my way up through that organization to be competition director back there. And then about 7 years ago, my wife and I decided to make the big move west. And here we are. I spent 4 or 5 years at Solitude running programming there, a stint at Snowbird in marketing, and time came where PCSS was looking for someone with my background and skills to come in and really take charge of organizing and hosting all of our on-snow competitions. And so that's where I'm at, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah. So maybe give us an idea of what does it take behind the scenes to put on a successful ski or snowboard competition that, you know, I mean, those of us just out watching would never see. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of lead up. Like right now we're finishing calendars. That starts in May, really, calendaring process and getting things registered with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. And then from there, you know, lining up people for timing and calculations and alpine events, which is a big deal for us, as well as figuring out our judge needs and freestyle and things like that, and planning out our larger events, such as Freestyle Junior Nationals, which is going to occur early March this year. So there's just a lot going in, and budget process and all that fun stuff. But really lining up staffing and making sure we have enough people on the hill to run events well and not with undue stress on too many people. So having more folks is always better.
Yeah. I guess as you look ahead to the upcoming season, I mean, how extensive is that competition calendar? And again, you're talking about a number of sports.
Yeah, so I mean, we host events for alpine, freestyle, Nordic jumping as well. So I start in December 20th this year. We'll start with 2 days of fist racing at the UOP, December 2021, and then we'll wrap up more than likely middle of March with free ride events.
Okay, and that's where all of the competitions happening at UOP?
We have competitions at the UOP and also at Park City Mountain Resort, or Park City Mountain.
Okay.
So most of our free ride and park feature stuff happens at Park City. The bulk of our alpining happens at the UOP. All of our Nordic jumping happens at the UOP because that's where they all are. Moguls events all happen at the UOP as well between our two venues.
Okay, well, a huge part of making the competitions happen is the volunteer workforce, as you
Correct.
Mentioned. How many volunteers do you expect to need this winter?
It's a moving target with every event, but we could use, you know, a couple hundred people in the pool to really pull things off with everything from gatekeepers to scorekeepers to judges' assistants, to people learning how to time, announce, anyone good on the radio, wants to speak. Always need announcers for all of our events. You know, we've got just so many opportunities that historically seem to go unfilled right now, and we cover the bases, but trying to reach out to the community and say, hey, if you've got any interest at all, we'd love to have you. And we've made it easier to sign up. If you go to the PCSS website and go under Get Involved and then Volunteer, there's a red button. It says Join PCSS to volunteer, I believe. And from there, it should be an easy shot through to get in there. Once you're in, Playmetrics is the site we use. We'll have events listed there. You can sign up for something that's interesting to you. I also have a generic kind of posting in there where you can just put your name in and we'll contact you and figure out what's best. There's a lot of opportunity for growth, and if you're thinking of 2034, it's a great opportunity to get involved with anything we're doing. A lot of the skills are transferable through all the disciplines, and so, you know, it's kind of a slow burn, but it's going to ramp up quick. And as you get involved with us, hopefully it helps you get picked for working with 2034 games.
Okay, so do you need volunteers with ski racing experience, or can somebody who just knows how to ski or snowboard?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you're just interested and you can ski or snowboard to a solid intermediate to expert level, we'll take you. If you can't, we'll take you as well and place you somewhere down at the bottom. Like, just want to be part of the action, part of the fun, and support our kids in pursuing their goals. It's really what we're all about. And, yeah, I mean... interest in snow sport is all we really want.
Okay. Oh, and in my opinion, coaches are a special breed in that they can stand in their ski boots all day, no True. Matter what the weather is. And I guess for somebody of these volunteers, is that kind of expected of them as well?
Depends on the role, but for sure, most of the opportunities are outside in the elements on a slope. And yeah, you gotta be able to bear the elements. Like I said, there are a lot of opportunities down at the bottom where you can be in sorrels on flattish ground. But yeah, I mean, we're a winter sport, and that's really where the need lies, is outside.
Yeah, so how much of a time commitment is required?
Yeah, it's kind of a full day. We do split up the opportunities kind of into half days, but depending on how many people we have signing up, like, I still need that person all day, the coverage all day. But showing up around 7, 8 in the morning and leaving around 3, not really 4, but by 3 we're usually wrapped up. In the morning we'll supply coffee and hot chocolate, things like that, to kind of welcome you. And sort of get you lunch, so you're taken care of during the day as well. So we try to take care of everybody out there and make it an enjoyable experience. And obviously, the more people we have, it becomes a less burden on the few that we do.
All right. Of course, Park City has a long history of producing elite winter sport athletes. And I guess, how important are these local competitions and, you know, kind of creating that pipeline?
Yeah, well, I mean, like any sport, you always want to compete at home on your home surface, whether it's a field sport or a pool or whatever. It just feels comfortable. So these things, you know, we start at the grassroots with town series as well, and all the way up through to Elite Fists. And yeah, it's super important. You know, if we weren't hosting these events, kids would be traveling up to Wyoming and Idaho and Montana and farther to get these events in. And that's a big burden, mentally, physically, financially. So yeah, we want to continue to be the host for all of our kids and supply the best product we can.
Yeah. Do you have a number at this point in terms of comps that you're going to have to be responsible for?
Yeah, you know, I haven't tallied it this year. It's got to be in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 competition days throughout the season, but it's quite a few. And, you know, last year being what it was, we hung on to a lot of stuff. We picked up NCAA championships. So we do a lot of fun stuff. This year we've got Aerials Nationals and NORAMs going on as well throughout the season, into January and February for those events. The calendar is kind of spread out right now, which is nice. It's not all saturated to a couple weeks in February. So it should be a nice season for us to really dig in and put on some great shows for people.
Okay. So, I mean, you're looking for a pool of 200 volunteers, but yeah, but then they cover, you know, what, 1,000 shifts or something? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, again, I haven't done the deep dive there, but it's a lot. And the more volunteers I have, the less paid staff I need to utilize from the coaching, and allows them, the coaches, to coach, and allows us to not pay staff as much, so we can be a little more profitable too. But just having bodies out there to help run things is what I'm after. Gatekeeping is the thing that still exists. It's a great way to get into Alpine. And then starters and choppers and judges' assistants on the freestyle type of stuff. All great ways to get involved and start learning more and working your way up the ladder if you want to pursue more involved positions on the Hill.
Okay, that's parkcityss.org?
Yes.
Okay, to register.
Yep, yeah, you go parkcityss.org, get involved, volunteer, get right through. You could also email us at events@pcss.org. That'll be an easy place for people to reach out as well. And myself or Barbara Yamada or somebody else could even, you know, make the connection. But yeah, I'm looking forward to a great season, and come on out and help us out.
Okay, Brent, thanks for your time this morning.
You're welcome, thank you.
Brent Greigel is the competition and events director for Park City Ski and Snowboard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.